Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Comic Wonk Podcast. I'm Philip.
I'm Justin.
I'm Bean.
And we are back here for episode 5. God damn it, Justin. But it's going to be an awesome show. We have a lot in store for you guys. First, we have a little bit of housekeeping to touch on. First, obviously, long overdue episode here. We went on a little bit of an unexplained hiatus. Long story short, you know, I've started two different jobs since we started this podcast. I've been trying to get a house on the market while the market's hot. A whole bunch of bullshit that doesn't actually matter. But, you know, the passion project went on the back burner. But we're coming back with a fervor, folks. Ooh. We've got, you can tell from the episode title, we've got a hot interview for you guys. A big, big catch. A big, big fish.
Big kahuna.
Yeah, big kahuna, there you go. That we were really excited for. We had a lot of fun with. Mm-hmm. But before we get into the interview, we also, through this hiatus, we've had a little bit of time to reflect. Right?
Realization.
Yes, right. We've kind of been able to listen to the episodes and kind of come to the conclusion that we might have something different than I envisioned, which I think we kind of knew going into it, this might change its shape or evolve. So I think what we're going to kind of go with is...
Phil's firing me.
Yeah. Justin's been demoted.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I understand.
His daughter, Bean Penelope here, is being promoted. She is now going to be the co-host of a new show we're calling Splash Comics.
Woo!
The Splash Comics Podcast. That's right, baby. And it's going to be covering all ages comics, right, Penelope?
Mm-hmm.
So we're pretty excited to provide content that little kids, adults, librarians, teachers, anyone can kind of enjoy. And maybe even creators, people in the comics industry will enjoy sharing and being able to recommend to their readers or the librarians they meet and so forth.
It also has a mascot.
Yes, it does have a mascot.
Yeah.
Because it's Splash Comics, you know, we're diving into the subject matter. Mm-hmm. Well, who dives into things better than...
A frog.
Froggies,
yo.
I'm going to draw something new for every season. So, during the winter, he's going to have a little Santa hat or something. Or during, like... During spooky times, also known as Halloween, we'll have him holding like a pumpkin or something, or a jack-o'-lantern.
Right.
Or during Thanksgiving, he'll be in a, like a little turkey hat. How cute would that be? A turkey hat?
On a frog?
On a frog.
Yeah, hook that up.
Yeah. In summer, maybe he's holding a little flower.
Right. Or something.
Swimming, swim trunks on.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be cute.
Maybe sitting with a little rainproof hat on during the spring.
Yeah, during the spring.
Umbrella. I like it.
We got to come up with a name for him, too. It'll be the Splash Comics.
Splashy.
Oh, Splashy. Splashy the Splash Comics Frog.
That sounds amazing. Like, did you hear how easily that just rolled
Splashy
off the tongue?
Splashy the Splash Comics Frog.
It really works.
He can go on t-shirts.
Oh, you got this live, folks.
That's right.
His name is Splashy the Splash
Write it down.
Frog.
Yeah.
That's right.
Tongue twister. Say that 10 times fast.
So what does that mean then for the show you're listening to now, to the Comic Wonk Podcast? Well, we will survive.
To your beloved co-host.
Yeah, we will carry on. Justin and I will be enduring his company while he struggles to keep up with all the comics I'm unloading onto his front porch. Like, hey, here's your reading list. But we're also going to be mixing in more interviews with folks, other people who are either very involved with they've read a lot of comics, or maybe they haven't. And spoiler alert, it'll be a lot of friends and family of people that we know, because that's how this kind of thing starts out. So, we also have wanted to get our review of Understanding Comics out there. Unfortunately, we ran into some technical issues with that. We're hoping we can still get that audio recovered. If not, we will be.
I'll do it again.
Oh, we will do it again, baby.
I loved that.
Oh no, it's happening. Yeah, honestly, we might have a second discussion on it, regardless. You know,
microphone or not,
it's probably gonna happen at some point. But we also want to still hit on getting into manga. We, of course, Manga May didn't happen. We're here in late August, and that never got off the ground. But there's no reason we can't still dedicate the next month, whatever month it might be, to manga and diving into comics from Japan. That'd be a whole lot of fun.
It's not manga May, but it's manga days. So you can manga still
days.
Sing it. Right?
Yeah,
manga
there you go. Days, manga right? days.
There you go.
You just want that song in there. And
I kind of need it. Yeah.
I don't blame you one bit.
Thank you.
But it'll be a lot of fun. So check the same feed out for those episodes coming to you in the very near future. And check out Splash Comics with me and Penelope for your all-ages comics content.
Congratulations on your promotion.
That's right. Anything else you guys wanted to touch on before we'll take a little quick break here and then get into the interview? Anything else you guys wanted to kind of lead out our listeners with? Reach out to us. We still haven't heard from barely any of you who aren't related to us. But all the rest of you, hey, it's thecomicwonk@gmail.com. Write us a damn letter.
Sure.
Okay?
Give us a letter.
Yeah, the decency of a letter. Yeah, we're not even asking for the review. We're not asking for the 5 stars. Let us know what you think personally, okay?
Ooh, no, don't. You can let them know what you think personally about them, but not me. It would hurt my feelings.
No. Spare Justin.
Thank you.
For me and Penelope, give us the constructive criticism. Give us the glowing praise. Give it all.
Yes. I'm a poor little child that might go walking around saying stupid things because I'm not getting criticism at all.
Yeah, right. That's right.
Write us notes.
Yeah, that's right. How else are we going to get better? Okay, but I believe that's what we're going to lead out on. You'll hear a quick little commercial break from our sponsor, and then we'll come back with an interview with Jim Benton.
Jim Benton,
creator of Catwad, the comic that Penelope and I discuss. Catwad, creator of It's Happy Bunny.
Right.
Which is grossed $750 million.
Shocking.
Yes. In marketing retail. That's crazy.
Wow.
Creator of multiple other all-ages series. Dear Dumb Diary, Franny K. Stein. Like, so much. I had no idea the catch that I had gotten when I had talked to this person on Reddit. So I really will even kind of touch on that in the interview, how we lucked into this situation.
Right.
So stay tuned.
Way, yeah, no good. Check out his new book, Drip and Blop.
And we'll have in the show notes how you can go ahead and find that book for yourself.
Awesome.
But yeah, there'll be a brief message and we'll come back with the interview. Bye.
Message.
So thank you so much for being here with us, Jim. Our first interview is here with Jim Benton, the creator of Catwad. That's a book that you and I spoke about before, Penelope.
Yes, I love Catwad.
We love Catwad. Before we get into your work, though, Jim, we actually wanted to ask you something just to kind of get to know you personally. And it's, I don't know if you had a chance to listen to Penelope and I's interview, but we like to ask about other things. It could be outside of comics. It could include comics. But what other media has spoken to you through the years that you feel like has left an impression on you as just a consumer or as a creator going forward?
So as a kid, I probably read equal amounts of trash and, you know, like good quality stuff.
Right.
So, and I probably liked the trash better. So I read a lot of comics. I read Mad Magazine. I read every knockoff that they ever did of Mad Magazine, like, like Cracked and Sick and Crazy and like every single one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, a lot of comic books. And then, you know, when I was very young, the books that I tended to gravitate to were the ones that were sort of grounded a little bit in reality, but also had a highly sort of surreal edge to them. So I liked characters like Pippi Longstocking, you know, who I thought was just, I don't know if you've ever read any Pippi, Penelope. Have you ever read Pippi?
No. But I'm sure
so,
my mom has.
Yeah, so Pippi was, you know, she was amazingly strong. She lived by herself. She had a pet horse, which she could lift. And, like, all of these strange qualities about Pippi, those were what was interesting about her. The fact that she was a girl, like, never came up. So when I started writing books, and I didn't realize this until later because I wrote the series Dear Dumb Diary, I wrote Franny K. Stein, and I like writing girl characters. I'm writing a series right now for DC Comics, And the babysitter is just emerging as one of the stronger characters. And I think it all sort of comes down to me just like liking female characters. Like I've always liked them. I write boy characters too, but I write a lot of girl characters.
That's good to hear. Strong female characters, always a good thing, especially when you're raising a daughter.
Yeah, and I never really thought about it. It wasn't intentional at all. It was just kind of how I write.
Yeah, you kind of just want to make a good character.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it turns out that girls can also be powerful as well. So think about it.
That's right.
It kind of comes
right.
out.
Right.
And for the most part, gender is the least interesting thing about a human being.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
You know, it's like it's like eyebrow shape or color. It's just, you know, that's just one feature. If they're doing a lot of other things, you hardly even notice.
It's true. Right. That is very true. As long as you can humanize sometimes some difficult, maybe more surreal, like you had said, characters, that's always a good thing. Mm-hmm. That is always a good thing.
Well, when I was writing, when I first started writing Dear Dumb Diary for Scholastic, one of the characters in there, her name is Angeline, and you know, she's really, really pretty. She's got beautiful hair. The main character, Jamie, is deeply envious of her. And at the very beginning, very, very beginning, my editor said, so, you know, like, we should probably write Angeline as a huge, or, you know, like, whoops.
We'll have to bleep Jim on that one.
As a you know, like a really unpleasant, mean girl type mm-hmm. character. And I said, no way. If I write her as a mean girl, all I'll be doing is writing that same character over and over and over that we've seen a lot of times. Angeline just was born with the defect of being really pretty. Yeah. Like that's not who she is. That's just how she looks.
Right.
And, you know, and as the series evolved, we realized that she was actually very sweet, very kind and generous and everything. She just happened to be born with the handicap of prettiness.
I really like that. And it speaks to, I think, too often in media, we had a girl character who would have to fulfill all the feminine roles at once, or non-feminine roles, if that might be the case. So it does speak to having more and more variety in our female characters, is, you know, that's going to have everything seem a lot more authentic and a lot more genuine.
And actually, I think a lot easier, because if the writer just write girls, you know, like you don't know any girls who just walk around being mean to everybody all the time. You've never met one. The only place you've ever seen that is in a movie.
I don't know. Penelope's pretty mean to me a lot.
Well, you're her dad, so you're sort of like the official punching bag.
That's true. That's true. It does kind of change things, I guess.
It's a different
Yeah. So here, I'll give you, this is my impression of Superman's children. Yeah. Nice panties, dad. But there's just, like, there's just no, there's just no way around that.
Yeah,
there's just no way around that dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Carry a piece of kryptonite in their pocket.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I think our next question, then, I think Penelope wanted to pose to you here.
When did you start drawing comics or writing comics?
So I started drawing when I was two. And I think that they used it as something to just get me to shut up and sit down because I was a busy, busy boy. And so they could, like, toss paper and pens into my cage, and that would calm me down. I wasn't really in the cage, but, you know, just toss them on the floor, and then I'd be fine. So when I was in school, like in elementary school, I lots of times kids who draw, they wind up being friends with other kids who draw, and we used to do this thing to make comics where you would take a piece of paper, and this is called the French fold, by the way. So you take a piece of paper and you fold it, and then you fold it one more time. And then you put a couple staples in the gutter there in the fold. And then you need a pair of scissors to sort of like lop a thin edge off that top. And now you have like a little 4-page book, right? So it was a really fast way to make a little 4-page book. And then we would draw on them little comics and cartoons, and then just sort of like release them into the wilderness. And, you know, other kids would draw on it. They might wreck it, or they might draw mustaches on it, or they might draw other stuff, or they might make their own. And so there was constantly these things floating around. You'd find them on the floor in the hallway, or, you know, some kid would grab a couple of them and he would give them back to you, or you'd read somebody else's. So it kind of started in elementary school. And I think a big part of it was because I was reading, I was consuming so much comics, you know, Mad Magazine and comic books, especially Batman. And I think that's kind of where that came from.
I have kind of a follow-up question on that, because I find that really intriguing. What a cool kind of free-form way in order to make comics, almost letting it out into the wild, like you said, and letting other people kind of take over and see what they do.
Yeah, almost mimetic.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Is there any like thing that you've done similar to that in your adulthood, where you've sort of given someone the structure and then kind of let it go and see what else somebody else comes up with?
Not really, but I post a lot of cartoons online, and people like to like blank your text and write in new ones.
Yes,
yeah, we
do. And so it doesn't really bother me when they do that. Sometimes they're funnier than what I wrote, and sometimes they're not. I don't like it when they put something, you know, like a Nazi joke in there or whatever.
Right.
But, no, lots of times it's just I'm just kind of curious to see what comes back. I'll tell you one thing that I did find really interesting. It was sort of along these lines. I go to school sometime and I talk to kids, and more often than not, we meet in the library, because it's usually the media specialists who set up these little events.
Right.
And then this one school, and maybe a lot of schools do this, but I've only seen one. They had kids bring in empty cereal boxes, and they would decorate the cereal boxes like with their own stuff. Like you would have the Penelope cereal box, right? And then what she would put in there is anything she feels like sharing. So, you know, like drawings she's done, or a story about herself, or, you know, like a Barbie doll head. She could stick anything in there that she wanted to. And then they had these things wrapped like books. And so if you want to, you could just go in, you could take down the Penelope book, you know, and dump it out on the table and see what was in there.
That's so cool.
So isn't that a cool idea? It was true. And then, of course, when they're lined up, they're beautiful, because they all do decorate the spines with their names. So, yeah, I always thought that was a cool idea. You could go in, I think I'll read a Penelope, you know, and then just dump it out and see what's in there.
What a cool way of kind of, you know, getting an idea of who everyone is. It sounds almost like you get to walk into their room.
Yeah. And if the kid wants to rebel and just stick a dirty sock in his, that's okay too, because we can learn a lot from that as well.
Yeah, there's nothing that you could put in there that would make it that you couldn't tell who kind of this that was. Isn't
reflective
yeah,
of exactly. The individual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or yeah. Yeah. May not be rebellion, may just be I have stinky feet. That's true. Yeah.
Could be.
Yeah, and I guess they could curate it if the kid put something hazardous in it, you know, like a rattlesnake or something. But I think for the most part, you'd want to give them a lot of freedom.
Yeah, but that's a really good idea. I think we could maybe do something even like that at home, just to kind of create something fun. She's Penelope's really creative. She likes to draw. She likes to make comics. She was kind of nodding her head along to the French fold thing. Like, yeah, that sounds like what we do. Yeah. So that sounds pretty similar to what she does. That's awesome.
I, if you guys don't mind, I'll take this.
Yes.
Kind of related to what you were just saying. So you meet with classrooms of children. We actually, Jim, you and I had bumped into each other in a Reddit thread that you had posted your works in a graphic novel subreddit. And there was a teacher who happened to say, hey, I recognize these. A lot of students in my classes are reading Catwad. And you proactively had offered, hey, I meet up with different classrooms. What's that experience been like? First, it sounds like that was happening pre-COVID. Is that right?
Yeah, that was. I'll tell you, sometimes when authors go in, and this is just, you know, like a peeve of mine, sometimes authors go in and they might have like, you know, a little slideshow prepared or whatever. And they kind of do a 45 minute commercial on why you should buy their books.
Yes.
Right? And the kid now is captive, like somebody who's wandered into one of these condominium sales, you know, pitches in order to get $20 worth of poker chips or whatever. And the kid can't escape. So, and that really bugs me. So what I do is I go in, I give them about 60 seconds on who I am. And I say, so, and I'm only doing it to legitimize myself. I'm not trying to make a sale. So I say, you know, I do Beardum Diary. I do Franny. I do Catwad. You know, I do It's Happy Bunny. I've done these things. And, but they're all around stories. So now let's talk about how we're going to make a story. And then that's what we do. I have, you know, big poster boards up and I start drawing and I explain, you know, I need it. You can start your story all kinds of different ways. We're just going to go quickly here. And I want to start with a character, but you can start with a time or a place or a mood or anything you want. I'm going to start with a character. So I need some ideas for characters. And then, you know, inevitably SpongeBob. Okay. I should have said, I need a fresh character. So nothing you saw yesterday, nothing you saw 3 days ago, because we want this to be hours, only hours. So then, they, you know, like the, somebody will have a breakthrough and they'll say a cupcake. You know, they'll say something sort of peculiar like that. And then we get a whole bunch of these things. I do it with places. And then we take a vote and I explain, you know, any of these things could be great. And we might incorporate them later in the story. But right now we are one big brain and we're just going to decide the story we want to tell. So then we vote and we start creating the story, right? And I talk about, we need some sort of conflict because every story is about this. Essentially, every story is about this. Somebody wants something badly and they're having a hard time getting it. Because if your main character doesn't want something badly, this really isn't that interesting to read. And if he gets it easily, it's over on page one, right? So that's basically what drives the story. So we talk about what they want and everything. So then we build the whole story. And I explained to them the secret of writing is rewriting. So anything that we've done here, we can go back and change later. So don't worry about it. We're just, you know, like there's the, I think it was Hemingway who said, write drunk, edit sober. So, you know, so you, yeah. So you just go crazy. Just put the ideas down. And if you don't like them later, you change them. So, and I'm getting around to something about this. Always very, very funny. So we come up with this thing and then, you know, we get to basically the third act of our story or whatever, if we're generally structured that way. And so I say, okay, now we got to land the plane. Do you want a happy ending or do you want a sad ending? And like thunder, every time the response comes back, tell me, Penelope.
Probably happy.
That's what I always think. I always shout sad. And I don't know if they're doing it because they know it's contrary. So it's funny, yeah. Right? Or they get such a, you know, like this cloying, choking diet of happy endings that they just want to see what happens when you get a tragedy, when you get a sad ending. Or if it's just perversity. They know what I'm hoping that they say, yeah. Or I think that they know. So they just say the opposite because it's hilarious, you know, to do it. So, anyway, so then we write the sad ending. And I said, okay, great. So we wrote the sad ending. Now, as an alternate, let's write the happy ending. And so we do this very quick. I'm very, very fast at drawing. And so, and then after we finish that story, I say, all right, so now you guys have experience. Now you guys are all authors. You're all, you know, very, very confident young authors. Let's do one more. And then we do it again. And the next one goes off like dynamite. I mean, they're firing very, very fast. The ideas are coming quickly. They still often want a sad ending. And then they usually come back and they say, so is this going to be, are you going to put this in a book?
Yes.
And I say, I can't because this isn't mine. This is yours. You know, I sort of took dictation here, but essentially this is your story. So you guys write it, you sell it, you change it any way you want. And I'll tell you the thing about that that's the most depressing is often I want to steal it because their ideas are really good.
Oh gosh, yeah. It's actually a really good story and I'd like to use this.
I would love to steal this, yeah. You know, from you little tykes, but who will be helpless against me in court. But I won't. And sometimes I get, you know, thank you letters from, you know, the teachers or the librarians or put together a little packet of thank you letters. And oftentimes the kids will expand on the story. Like I'll see the characters again and stuff that they did on it. And, you know, it makes me think, well, maybe one of you or all of you will be writers one day.
That's excellent. You know, it kind of strikes me, Jim, this may be the adult version of the, of the French fold, yeah. Right? You let it out into the wild. You have that structure now as an adult. You can kind of lead them a little bit, show them kind of, okay, this is where it can go. What are you going to do with it? But maybe... So
I'll tell you one more about this. And the only reason I'm going to tell you this is because I'm not on camera. Because I invariably well up and weep when I tell this one. So, and hopefully I can disguise this in my voice. Or maybe I've told it so many times now that I'm sort of insulated against it. But one time I did one of these things, and the library had like a long wall that was designed to pin things up on, like one of these carpeted sort of walls. Yeah. And so before the kids got there, I pinned up a whole bunch of my poster boards. So I wasn't just working on one. I could move from one to another one quickly. And so I prepared for the things. And the teacher said, you should know that there's some special needs kids in the class. And I said, okay. And they go, so you're probably not going to want to call on. And I go, why's that? And they say, well, because lots of times the stuff that they will answer or will respond, like, it won't be on topic. Okay. And I'm thinking, it often isn't anyway.
Right.
I'll say, okay, who's got a question? And somebody raised their hand, like, what's your question? And they say, I have a cat. You go, okay. Not strictly speaking a question, but how wonderful for you. Now, anybody else have a question? I also have a cat. Wonderful. We've got lots of cats. Who's got a question? So that happens all the time anyway, special needs or otherwise. Right. So, and I go, okay, so, and how am I going to know these kids? Well, you'll know them because of their physical features, or they'll have a caregiver with them. I forget the name. Oh, parapro with them, sort of like, so anyway, so we started doing these things, and I said, okay, so who has an idea for another character? And this one little girl raised her hand, and visually you could sort of make that she was, you know, like, she had some needs, and she had a parapro with her. And I said, I go, you know what, sweetheart, why don't you come up here and draw it for us? And, you know, she jumps up and she's going to do it. And I sort of did that because I wanted to stick my thumb in the eye of the librarian that sort of told me to avoid them, right? So she came up and she's over to one side, and I'm drawing my castle or whatever. I don't know what it is. And I'm talking while I'm drawing. And then I realize I've lost them. I've lost the audience. And I look over at the kids, and they're looking at her. They're watching what she's drawing. And she can draw like crazy. And they didn't know it. And so for kids, like, drawing is one of those things that kids respect, right? Like, they respect physical abilities. They respect drawing. They respect, you know, playing an instrument. There's certain things that kids always admire in other kids. And, like, I knew that in that moment, everything they thought about her had changed.
Yeah, complete paradigm shift.
And I'm sure it wasn't just you. You know, I think a lot of times that they don't give kids those opportunities, especially special needs kids, those opportunities to see really what they can do. I can't always blame them. You know, they're so focused on trying to meet a set of criteria that they're required to teach these children, and this is what they must do. So they can't, you know, always go outside of that box. But when somebody presents them that opportunity and says, hey, let's go outside the box and see what you can do, you can see some real magic happen. And that's a wonderful story. It's a beautiful story.
Yeah. And that was hands down my favorite one. Although it has been pointed out to me, you know, she could have written some really intense profanity over there.
Yeah.
You would have been powerless to do anything about it in that moment.
Yeah. It gets a little more awkward. Thank God she didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I had no restrictions on what she was going to draw, right? So that could have gone differently, but it went perfectly.
It's hard to tell them what not to do, too. Like, well, you can't draw those. You can't draw these. Then you're the one being explicit.
Yeah, and if you say don't draw them, you can be certain that's what you're getting.
Oh,
you
know,
exactly.
So anyway, so that stands out as probably my absolute favorite one, although... when I go and do these things, it is a lot of fun. I'm like, I'm switched on for like a full hour, and at the end I need a nap, and I do not know how teachers do it. Yeah. Because I think that they probably learn methods to kind of like pace themselves.
Exactly.
So, you know, I'm up there bouncing around like Robin Williams or something, and they've learned how to like slow it down.
Yeah.
Can I help you? Do you have a question?
Have you ever drawn a comic book and started off with just a couple dots with some faces on them? Because I do that a lot. I draw dots, and then I give them little facial expressions, and then I add the story after that.
You know, there's so many ways to do a story. There's so many ways to come at it that I think that when you find something that gives you results, that you should just go for it. So if you do, when you say dots, is it like a, like how do you, is it like a colored dot? Like how do you see the expression you've drawn?
They can just be little, they could be little scribbles of little, like they could be like little frowny brows, eyebrows. They, yeah. It could be just like the fact that it's all like kind of messed up or like droopy. Maybe they're sad or like maybe they're really mad.
Yeah, but, I think it sounds great. You know, I've heard people say that the human brain is the universe feeling consciousness, like because we're, you know, like we're the most advanced sort of thing that there is. So like intellectually. So, although you can't tell it every election cycle. So, but when you come up with a way to express yourself and it works for you, I think that that's great. I mean, sometimes you're writing stories in the back of your mind and you don't even know it. Robert Louis Stevenson said that he dreamt Jekyll and Hyde, that he woke up and he knew the story. So I think that sometimes, you know, like when you are creating these stories, you might actually be discovering a story that some other part of your mind already wrote.
Right.
So, yeah, I think any way you get there, Penelope, is a great way.
That's super interesting to me that you said that, because I think that there that extends past just creativity in like arts or media. I've heard a number of different inventors and folks who've created or come up with great scientific advancements say the same thing. That they didn't know the answer to these questions. They fell asleep and then they had it. So when they woke up, it was just there. I think it was Tesla who used to say he's pulling this from some sort of unconscious, greater universal mind, that he's just essentially this stuff. And I write what I hear. So he didn't really like taking credit for those kinds of things. That which was interesting. So yeah, I do think there is definitely something to that, that there is something going on in the background in the subconscious that maybe we're not always aware of. That we're pulling from and understanding things at even maybe a deeper level.
So there was an artist who did an illustration for Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It was a reprint. And he believes he was the first one to discover this. So he had written something like a letter that's written by Dr. Jekyll. And so he, you know, there's a lot of mirror themes in, you know, in the storyline. And so it was just a letter that was on like a tabletop and there was a little tilted mirror next to it. So when you wrote Jekyll, you saw the mirror image of the word Jekyll in the mirror.
Cool.
And when you write Jekyll in cursive and you have to stylize it just a little bit, it spells Hyde.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those things that Robert Louis Stevenson never mentioned. And some people believe he didn't know that this was something his subconscious mind wrote, you know, because the story is kind of like, it's about a subconscious mind written by a subconscious mind.
Right.
And that little phenomena is something that his head put in there that he was never aware of in his lifetime.
That's incredible. But
you have to sort of stylize it. You'll see what I mean. Big curvy J and K-Y-L-L. And then when you look at it, you know, you hold it up to the light. If you don't have a mirror, you can see how it really, really looks like Hyde.
That's awesome. That's really cool.
Yeah. And I'd never heard that.
Me either.
I'm suddenly very interested in Dr. Jekyll.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I don't know if you've ever read the book, but it's like a pamphlet. It's shockingly short.
Oh, yeah.
I hadn't heard. No, I always expected it kind of to be long. I haven't read it either, but you know, it's more like you have to understand the themes, I guess, to get some other media. I've seen Animaniacs about it though, so I know all about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the other things that's sort of weird is his name is Henry Jekyll, but in the book, sometimes he's referred to as Harry, which is it's a nickname of Henry. But so you even have another identity on top of that identity. You know, it's occurring in more than one place than the obvious one.
That's awesome. I love stories like that, that have so many layers to pull back from. And you can examine it from multiple angles and a number of angles that you weren't even aware of to begin with.
Yeah. You can probably get the Kindle for $1.
I should check that out. Maybe we should read that.
Exactly. If I can just grab it real quick. Then if you guys don't mind.
No, please. Phil, go ahead.
We can shift then into some conversation more about your work, Jim. The reason that I reached out to you is because I was familiar with Catwad because of Penelope's recommendation.
Yes.
So if you don't mind, I'd want to start there. It's clear from how you were speaking about your love of Mad and other comic, like other spoofs of Mad in the past. Humor is definitely seems like it's something that would be important to you. Mm. So Catwad, the odd couple pairing, is that something that you specifically sought out to create, or did they just kind of manifest themselves?
So it started out years ago. Catwad's actually a lot older than you might think, and because I do so much in licensing. So It's Happy Bunny was one. It's Happy Bunny is probably my best known license, but I've done licensing before that a lot. It's Happy Bunny has done $750 million at retail. And it makes it a real standout, even in the licensing community. Nice. So because I create things like that, one of the things I created was Catwad. And, you know, it, like a lot of the stuff was the sort of same kind of thing. It was the character depicted, and there was like a, you know, one or two sentence little joke. And it was for products like t-shirts and everything. And somebody at Scholastic knew about it and wanted to do a book with it. And so we'd gone over it many, many times when I was going like, I don't really see a book in this, you know, like, I think that this is kind of like a one-off joke. Like each one of these little panels is like, it's just I really don't see it. So I went to breakfast with a few people at Scholastic and they all wanted me to do it. And I said, I really don't know. You know, and I was sketching on a napkin and I drew Catwad and then I drew Catwad again. But the one I drew the second time, I put a big dumb grin on its face. And when I did that, I went, you know, I think I know how to do it.
I think
all of a sudden I think I know a way to make this funny. And it can only be because, you know, there's kind of a yin yang going on there, that there's, you know, these two forces. And the way I described it at the time is this character here, if he smells flowers, he looks around for the casket. and this character here, if he sees a casket, he assumes it's full of candy.
That's hilarious.
And that's the tent poles of the series. So so as soon as I saw that, then we did a contract and I did 6 books.
That's impressive that came that one kind of
it came from drawing Catwad with a happy face, because that's what Blurmp wound it up to be. Although in the Spanish edition, he's not called Blurmp. In the Spanish edition, well, evidently taco means wad. So we had to come up with a different name for Catwad first off, which is Pangato, which is like cat loaf. But then I was told Blurmp doesn't translate, even though it's just a sound.
Yeah.
And I said, how could that be? And they go, because that particular combination of letters doesn't exist in Spanish, and it's very difficult to pronounce.
Yeah.
So I called somebody that was quite fluent in Spanish, and they said there's a sound that sometimes used conversationally the way we might use you know, like just a sound, and it's bois. Like BWA. So in the Spanish edition, he's not called Blurmp, he's called Bwomp. So,
anyway. And Gato and Bwomp.
What's that?
Pengato and Guam.
Yeah, Pengato and Guam.
I like that. That is good. That we often call our cat a loaf, so it works really well for us.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's how that started. And then also at the time I was reviewing some of the other things that Scholastic was doing and some of their titles that were really, really popular, like Bad Guys.
Yeah.
Do you know that series Bad Guys?
I love that book too.
Yeah, that was also committed to me. I've read both now.
Yeah. So I looked at it and when I talked to my editor about it, I go, you know that the word count on that averages out to 17 words per page, right? And they go, what are you talking about? And I go, it's 17 words per page. That's the average. I bought two of the books and I counted them. And they were quite surprised at that. Yeah. So I said, I think that there's probably a reason for me to write this like as really, really fast jokes, like really, really quick chapters, really, really quick jokes.
Yeah.
And because I think that the signal we're getting is that some readers, you know, they want it that way.
Uh-huh.
So that's what we did. And it turned out to be, I wasn't as correct as Dave Pilkey from Dogman was, but I was pretty correct. The books have done well. And Dave gave me a burst on one of the books.
Oh, really? Nice. Yeah, that is nice. Yeah, and it's just great to hear. Part of the interview with Penelope and I, we discussed how all ages comics have really flourished in what feels like, this past decade or so. So yeah, it's fun to hear that even the creators are all in the same circle, all talking to one another.
How do we do this?
Yeah, so there's one I did called Clyde. It's with IDW. And there's another one I did with Paper Cuts that's called Attack of the Stuff. And they're both kind of written for kids, but also adults read them too. So, I think that you can write comics that work across the board. It just sort of depends on subject matter. And, sometimes I think when people are writing for adults, they lean a little too hard on adult themes.
Yes.
When the truth is, you know, like adults, you know, and sure, they'll find that stuff funny, but adults were also kids. So they find the kids stuff funny as well.
Right.
So I think that I don't think it's really that tough to write for all age groups.
I was going to ask you about that, actually. Penelope, I know you have a question. Or did you have a question, Penelope? I'm sorry.
I did, yeah. But you can go first.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay. Because that was something that really struck me as I was reading these books. You know, Penelope came out with Catwad and she was like, this is really good. You have to read this. You have to read this with me. And of course I did. And they are really good and they are really funny. And it did strike me at how maybe difficult it would be to decide what is too explicit for this market or what is appropriate for kids these days. I hate to put that in quotation marks because, you know, kids are kids. And I think they've kind of always been that way. But there is certainly a little bit more attention, I think, that's being paid from adults these days to what they're reading. Mm. Did you find any pushback or difficulty at from your publishers or editors or anybody who said, ooh, I don't think you should write it like that?
Well, like Philip, I'm also an uncle and I have 24 nieces and nephews because my wife is Catholic.
So,
I've and they've grown, you know, they have kids of their own, some of them now. So I've grown up trying to tell jokes to 3-year-olds and also telling jokes to my buddies.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a sense of what works, but when I'm writing like Dear Dumb Diary, we got pushback on all the time just because it said dumb in the title. And because the character Jamie is edgy. I mean, she spends a lot of time angry.
Sure.
So, but I think that, I have a belief that if you bore children, bad things should happen to you because you were a child. And if somebody had told you to write a book for an orangutan and you bricked it and you did a bad job, you'd say, well, what do I know? Right. Yeah. I thought those banana jokes would play.
That's supposed to be good. They love that stuff.
right. So if you blow that, you have an excuse. But if you bore children, you don't because you were a child. and you know what bores them. And I think that if you write a book that's too innocent,
yeah,
then kids kind of know that you've watered the, they know you've watered the Kool-Aid, and they want you to, I mean, kids want to bump up against adults a little bit. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like, I like to write stuff that I know is going to make grandma gasp, you know, when you show it to her, but she's going to get it. She's not, she's just sort of playing along. So it's not really scandalous. It's just like kooky enough that they go, oh my, he, look, one cat swallowed the other cat and then barfed him back up. Oh dear. Oh dear. Why don't you read Little House on the Prairie?
Right.
Knowing full well that there's space for both books. There's space for all kinds of jokes. And Jerry Seinfeld had a very great quote when he was talking about children. And he said, make no mistake, they're here to replace us. Huh. And which I think is brilliant, right? It's they don't want the Kool-Aid watered. In fact, they don't even like it at the recommended intensity. They want it a little more.
Right, you know? Right. You're always kind of another,
yeah. Make that a little redder, will you, Dad?
Yeah, exactly. So, sugar, more.
Yeah.
And also, like you said, the adults don't want things that are trying too hard to be overly adult and mature, because it's the same kind of thing. You're kind of talking down to me or feeding me what you think I want.
Right, right.
Right. So I stay away from anything that's like political, although Franny does have some stuff in it that's kind of social, a lot of social messages in Franny about the importance of being yourself and letting other people be themselves and, you know, and stuff like that. But I don't, you know, I want to be really careful to not try to give kids politics or give kids religion. I will give them like some social messages, like just be nice. But there's some things that I avoid because I expect a pushback. But like one time, one of the Dear Dumb Diary books, one of the sort of like B stories was about this girl that bit her nails. And I got an angry letter from a little girl telling me that it was very mean for me to write a story about somebody that bit their nails and that I am not her friend anymore.
Oh.
And that You shouldn't make fun of something like that. And so, and I wrote her back and I apologized. I said, I wasn't trying to hurt anybody's feelings. And sometimes people bite their nails for a lot of different reasons, but most of the time people discover that if they concentrate and they work really hard, eventually they might stop. And after they stop, their fingers look better and they're happier and they don't look nervous all the time. But it's just a story. You know, it's not about anybody. Although I kind of had a strong sense that she was a nail biter and she was struggling with it herself. And that's why she took the time to, you know, scold me and unfriend me for
or upset about something that they're not actively doing. Right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And everybody bites their nails once in a while anyway. Some people more than others, but anyway.
Speaking as a chronic nail biter, Jim, I was for many years, and you are absolutely right. I have stopped biting my nails with the power of concentration. So it works.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's better, right? And you still might bite one once in a while, you know, like if you're absentmindedly. It's not like and even in the book, this wasn't like a cardinal sin or anything. She just, she was nervous. She was doing it because she was nervous.
Right. So. Well, yeah, it's not as if, yeah, she's doing something terrible or awful.
No. I think, if I remember right, I think in the book they got her on pencils.
I used to do that too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It is a very satisfying crunch when you come down with all of your pressure on a number two pencil.
Oh, I loved it. Oh, give me a good Ticonderoga.
Yeah. You hear the wood splinter. You get the dental imprints when you take it out.
We better stop now or I'm going to go find a pencil. I haven't done it in a long time, but now that we're talking about it, I'm getting the urge again. Like, I don't know if they have pencil anonymous meetings, but maybe I should go.
Oh, I'm sure there's a group.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And if there isn't, you'll start it. There'll be friends of Justin.
Mm-hmm.
It'll work.
Yeah.
Did you, Penelope, did you have any other catwad questions?
I did have a catwad kind of a comment.
Let's hear it.
You were talking about how you try to make your Catbod comics for like all ages and try to make it funny for all ages. And I was finishing my Catbod book. My grandparents had picked me up and I was finishing it at their house. And I was like, Grandma, Grandma, you got to read half of this. You got to read at least half. And then she loved it. She laughed and she was like, that's great. That's funny. And then I showed it to my grandpa and I was like, you got to read some of this. You got to read some. And he loved it too. And you know, you really do great work on making your comics for all ages.
Thanks very much. I'll also tell you, I try to use materials that kids have access to. So I collect fountain pens and I have some really fancy pants fountain pens, but I never use those on projects because kids sometimes ask me what I use and I know it's because they want to try them.
You want to do it too?
Yeah. So I always try to use really accessible and inexpensive art supplies on my projects. So Catwad is all drawn with flare pens.
Cool.
And it's roughed with a pen, usually on just regular copier paper. And then it's finished on a really inexpensive Canson multimedia paper. Cool. But the pen that I use, they're just flare pens. And the other thing I do is because I mash them down, you know, the points get mashed down.
Right.
So when a pen is new, right out of the package, it gets a little piece of tape around it. So I know when I look at my drawing board, which is the newest one, and which will have the nice sharp point.
There you go.
And that other one over there, I've blunted a little bit. So that's more useful for like filling in black areas or something right. like that. And then as time goes on, of course, the tape pen gets demoted and a new pen gets to wear the tape.
I have one more. Jim, this has been really fascinating. And I really appreciate you taking the time out and doing this because now I'm thinking about a lot of things.
Eating pencils.
Well, that too. That was in the back of my mind for sure. I wasn't going to say it, but I guess, yeah. Well, I kind of entered this journey as probably the most novice. My daughter and certainly Phil have been more into comics as a medium than I ever was. I'm trying to learn more about comics kind of as we go along. And it strikes me how much accessibility there is in comics for youth to be able to do things and kind of create their own in a way that is, I don't want to call it legitimate, but can really be as impactful as, let's say, a produced or published comic. It strikes me as kind of being a little different than making a movie. And when you mention that you do all of this work with things that kids can also buy, that really struck a chord with me because I see my daughter sort of doing that, reading and ingesting these items and these different kinds of comics and graphic novels, and then going and kind of trying to make her own. But it strikes me so different because we've also seen a lot of movies. We've seen Disney, and she doesn't go and try to make Disney movies, you know, like that almost just seems like out of the question. There just isn't a way to, she can't hop on and do Photoshop, and she can't hop on and I mean, she could if she tried, I'm sure, but it just requires so much more technical knowledge, access to maybe the items that they just wouldn't be able to buy or have. Exactly. There's a lot of barriers of entry to it. And I guess this was a long way of saying, I really appreciate that you actually thought ahead about that, that you thought to make your comics and your books representable for kids to do on their own, because you're dead on. They do want to do it and they do want to make it. When you see something like that, you want to see how you can do it too. And to be able to actually make something that is comparable, that is similar to what you've seen, must be a really enjoyable and like fulfilling practice for kids to see that. So thank you for that, because that was a really meaningful thing to think about before you even set out on creating your works. So that was a long way of saying thanks for that. I appreciate it.
Sure. And Penelope also, like, if you're going to be a doctor, you have to wait. You got to go to college, and then, you know, it's a long process and everything. But to be an artist or a writer, you can start today. So your career begins when you decide you want it to begin. All of the, like, they won't let you just doctor because you want to, right? But drawing and writing, you start that right away. So Penelope, you are every bit the artist I am. You're every bit the writer I am. We're just working in different areas, and we're on kind of like different places on our paths. But you're family. I mean, this is, when you're doing it, you're doing the same thing that I'm doing. And if you want to go way, way back in time, you can look up Hokusai. That's Hokusai. He's the guy. Have you ever seen that Japanese print of the wave coming up and all the foam looks really like curly claws? Okay, that's Hokusai. Hokusai probably invented manga and called it hanga manga. Now, if you want to look it up, Justin, I would advise some curation. Because Hokusai worked in a lot of different ways. And some of his stuff is a little bit saucy, but a lot of his stuff is just hilarious. And that's one of the great, great grandfathers that kind of like opened a lot of this up was Hokusai.
Interesting. My first kind of introduction here was I started reading Understanding Comics. I don't know if you're familiar with what's the author's name? If I cannot remember.
Oh, Scott McCloud.
Scott McCloud. Yeah, that was fantastic. That kind of opened my mind to a lot.
I'm sure Jim Benton's heard of
Understanding. Yeah, probably. Comics. Okay. Yeah. I'm not very smart. So yeah. This is all new to me. Mm. But it really did kind of open my eyes to a lot of the differences, the artistry, just a better understanding, of course, one would hope after reading Understanding Comics, but a better appreciation for it as well. Mm. And that is still an area that I don't really have a ton of knowledge about, is kind of the manga kind of side of things. Although I'm terribly interested in that, I would love to go look that up here after we're done and see kind of what that's all about. So I will practice some curation, though, to make sure nothing too saucy gets through when I'm passing it down through to Penelope.
Yeah, I think the first graphic novel, I think often they attribute it to Contract with God. I think that's the Will Eisner one. And I believe that many people, it's kind of hard to pinpoint exactly because graphic novel is just a term, you know, like. But I think a lot of people consider that one of the very first. And Will Eisner is actually the namesake of the Eisner Awards and probably best known for his character, the Spirit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've had some discussions about that now. It's impressive. His work is really, really good. So that was very iconic. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I think I would have a question kind of related to the encouragement you were giving Penelope there. We do, for all of our aspiring artists in the in our listening base, we have to hit the boring stuff, Jim. I got to ask about like managing goals and creating structure when you are your own boss in that kind of situation. Mm-hmm. Is it all fun and games? And if you do give the answer to encourage kids to just slack off and draw on their notebooks all day, I'm okay with that.
Yes.
Okay. Well, here's the thing. It is all fun and games.
Yes.
The truth is that, you know, I tried real work and it did not agree with me.
wait. Real work. What you do is real work, Jim.
No. I know the difference. I know that what I get to do is a lark. And like when if I'm having a real tough time getting a drawing of a dog just the way I want it, I know that there's somebody somewhere that's mopping out the bathroom in a Texaco station. And I know the difference, right, between what is joy and what is really, really hard work. Yeah. So sometimes it's frustrating. Sometimes it's terrifying. You know, like for some people that, you know, they might have a hard time making a living at it. But yeah. I think for the most part, they're forging ahead anyway. And they're forging ahead because it's a delight, and working in the arts, expressing yourself artistically, that's something that that everybody loves to do.
Yeah.
You know, it's, and to be able to do it all the time and to be able to do it and get paid,
yeah.
You know, it's a racket. It really is. Sometimes I talk to, when you're talking about the, you know, the more career sort of stuff, I talk to parents sometimes and they're concerned about letting their kid, you know, like be an artist, because there's a lot of people who can't say the word artist without the word starving in front of it.
Yeah, where's the money?
Where's the money? So I explained, you know, like there's all kinds of occupations, but if we think of something that you might think of as being more stable or more lucrative, we'll say doctor, lawyer, you know, engineer, chemist. So all of these people, they go to work, but when they hop in the car, they put on the radio, they listen to music. And when they get home, there's photographs and paintings on the wall. And then they, you know, they watch movies or they read a book, they listen. So the arts are actually more pervasive than these other things. They surround these people and they give them joy. They give them relaxation. And that's because that's what artists are contributing. Artists contribute a different way of seeing things and thinking about things. And it's very important. Now, sometimes some types of art are tougher to make a living with, because sometimes if the person is moving in very avant-garde sort of directions with their work, it's just tougher for people to appreciate.
Right.
And so, you know, there's people that might be doing like, you know, death metal folk disco, and they just aren't selling the number of records that Ariana Grande is.
Shocking.
It's not that they're not as good or it's not as interesting. It's just the audience isn't as big.
Right.
So, I give artists all the time the suggestion, cultivate a commercial style, and it doesn't have to be the only thing you do, but know the difference and cultivate a quick style, because if it takes you 10 years to do a comic, in that interim, you're probably going to have to do other things you don't feel like doing.
Right. At
some point.
So just being realistic about that is important. And then also you have to develop a thick skin, because Penelope, if you made me a sandwich, if I said, okay, Penelope, I want you to make me lunch. Okay. I want a salad, a side, and a drink. So you go ahead and you tell me what you're going to make for me.
A salad, a side, and a drink.
Let's say a sandwich. You're going to make me some kind of sandwich, some kind of side, and some kind of beverage. So I want you to tell me now what it is you're going to give me, the exact thing.
Ooh.
Okay, we're putting some ham in your sandwich. Now we're closing it up because we don't want the ham to get
mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to take a long time to figure out what we're going to put on it next.
Okay, what about my side? What's the side going to be?
Okay, the side. Your side is going to be some French fries, but they're not normal French fries.
Oh, heavens.
They're cut up into tiny little squares.
All right. Like hash brown, like home fries or something?
Mm-hmm. Just a bunch of normal. Okay, you're taking normal fries and then you're just cutting them up. Just a bunch of tiny ones.
Okay. And now what's my drink, Penelope?
You're getting ham juice from... That we squeeze the bread from the ham.
So that's my dog.
Okay, so now Penelope, when I tell you this, I'm not eating that lunch. Okay, I'm just not going to, and I'm not going to tell you why. I'm just saying I'm not eating it. So now you shouldn't feel bad, because you don't know why I rejected it. You don't know why I don't like it. You are not the sandwich. You are not the side, and you are not the drink, any more than you are the things you draw. So if somebody doesn't like a comic you've done, it's not you that they're rejecting. They just didn't like that one comic. And it's important that you always remember that you are not your work, any more than you are the sandwich you made for somebody. You are not the cartoon you made for somebody. Right? You can't let it hurt your feelings if somebody doesn't like something. Now, would I really eat that lunch? I got questions about the ham juice, but the rest, The rest of it I would eat. But see, you don't know. When you're making a lunch for somebody, you don't know what they like. They might be allergic to ham or whatever. They might have a dietary restriction. It's got nothing to do with your decision. It's their decision. So you can't blame yourself for their decisions. So that's one of the other things that I always want to tell kids is that you are not your work.
I think kind of our last question to leave us here is I wanted to ask about your latest book. It's the Jop and Blip Want to Know series. Can you hear a penguin fart on Mars?
Love it.
That's right. So my first editor on Dear Dumb Diary, she went over to HarperCollins and we talked all the time because we became good friends and I respect her a lot. She's a great editor. And so she had asked me, could I do an educational book?
Right.
And I said, let me think about it a little bit. And so I sort of came up with the conclusion that here's how we don't teach kids. Here's how kids don't want to be taught. We don't say, okay, sit down for 18 minutes and let me talk to you about robots.
Lectures.
They don't like it. The way people learn is the way that we learned during this conversation. When you called me up, you didn't know we were going to talk about Hokusai. You didn't know we were going to talk about Jekyll and Hyde. It's just how conversations work. And so in this book, I said, that's how I want to write these books, is I want it to be like organic, like a conversational thing. We don't really know where we're going to end up, but we're not going to let that stop us. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the qualities of the book. And the other one is I want to begin and end with the notion that all questions are valid, that you can ask an absolutely ridiculous question, something that sounds weird or dumb or whatever. And it's not. It's everything is worth knowing. Every question is worth answering. So and these robots, they sort of ask questions like that. Neither of them is smarter than the other one. They both know certain things, but they're willing to try to figure it out. So when one of them just out of nowhere asks, can you hear a penguin fart on Mars? they decide to take it very seriously.
Right. This is not a crazy question to ask. This is a legitimate question and let's figure it out. I love that.
Let's figure it out. And so there's a lot to it, you know, like.
It turns out what's the makeup of a fart? What's the atmosphere on Mars? You got to learn.
That's right. All this stuff. Right. Right. Like, can you even just go out and buy a penguin to experiment on?
Right.
How do we get, like, what's, like, give me a ballpark. What's it going to cost to get one to Mars?
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, like, immediately they point out, you can't send one penguin to Mars. Penguins are really gregarious. They have to have, you have to send at least two penguins because otherwise they'll be miserable.
Yeah, that's right. Ethically.
And also it's going to take a long time to get them there. So we also have to accommodate the food. And here's how much food a penguin eats.
That's fantastic.
So then we get all the way, you know, we start discussing, as you say, about atmosphere on Mars. And it does have some atmosphere. It's not like ours, but it has a little bit.
Right.
Then there's just the anatomy of a bird compared to the anatomy of grandma.
Right,
which they compare their two anatomies, and then they go through it all and they actually come up with the answer.
I love that. You know, that strikes me too. Penelope, especially when she was younger, used to ask me questions sort of similar to that all the time. And similar questions, yes, Penelope. And I never know the answer to those. But I love science and I love looking things up. So that was kind of our journey as well. Like, I don't know, kid, but let's try to figure it out. Let's see what happens. So that's a really
unique
way. I love that.
Yeah, I used to do illustrations for a child psychologist. And one of the things that he taught me was that there's a lot of pushback on Sesame Street. And in particular, the segment, you know, which one of these things is not like the other? Because I'm going to tell you, kid, there is one answer and it takes you exactly 35 seconds to get it.
Right.
And when you put those sort of limits on questions and answers, it's not really how things work.
Yeah, you're not getting
it. Right. And so like when you say which one of these is not like the other, well, I mean, there's a lot of criteria.
Right.
So like if somebody said, well, does this shirt go with these pants? and they go, and they smell the same.
Right.
You know, so yeah, they're perfect. They're a perfect match that way. So there's a lot of ways to look at information and stuff. And one of the other key things in this book is that at one point, Jop, who's the taller one, who was originally going to be Jot, but we found out there was another character named Jot. So we used a computer programming thing. So at one point he explains to Blip that, you can know a lot about something and not know everything about it.
Yep.
You can be kind of right and kind of wrong at the same time. Mm. And so, which I think is really, really important.
Very meaningful. That's deeply philosophical in a way that, you know, you don't usually find in the children's books. I like
right.
that.
Right. And he explains what, you know, the fable of the blind man and the elephant.
Yeah.
That they were, and the elephant kind of comes back. I use the elephant because it comes back later on in another thing. But how they were kind of right and kind of wrong at the same time. They wanted to understand the elephant, but they couldn't see the whole picture.
Right.
And so I wanted to also include that in there, that any information that we give you, you can also cross-examine. I mean,
right.
You know, it's written down here and there's funny illustrations. You can cross-examine it. That's okay. That's good.
These come with asterisks. They all come with further information still necessary or possibly missing. Right. So, yeah.
I've heard that there's something like 20% of the stuff that doctors are taught is obsolete in 10 years.
Oh, I would think, right? Like, you know,
scary.
A little scary, a little, but at the same time, usually it's because they're making progress. They're right. usually yeah. figuring out that, they were wrong. Because we're missing something extra.
Yep.
So if we add this new piece to it, then we've got a much better rounded picture. That's the scientific process.
Yeah, it's the same thing that it happened with COVID. You know, like when we were first quite aware of it, it's like, oh, wash the Doritos. And then later, okay, maybe we don't have to wash the Doritos, but wear a mask. Okay, well, that hasn't changed so far. I think we should keep wearing the mask.
Yeah, and probably. So,
you know, like those, that information changes because we learn more,
right?
Mm-hmm. And in fact, now that I'm thinking about it, and maybe this will be in the next book, you should probably be deeply suspicious of anything that hasn't changed in a long time, because it probably means nobody's examined it.
Yes,
right. Sounds more like a dogma. You're supposed to just follow unquestioned.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And I love it. I love it when you see an article and they say, "Oh yeah, we think we know how gravity works now. There's these things called gravitrons." I'm like, "Oh yes." Uh-huh. Yes, we've made this new major super weird discovery, and I love that.
I do too. I'm a big fan of that kind of science that is on the edge of being almost not a science at a certain point.
Yeah, the weirder the better. I was just reading about some guys that believe that inanimate objects might have consciousness.
Yeah, exactly. And it kind of forces, I think, people who are looking at that critically to think about themselves and what role they must play. What are we? Are we just photons and atoms and gravitons? Ooh, that feels weird. I don't know if I like that. And then, you know, you kind of have to think a little bit about it, which I appreciate.
Yeah. Penelope, you work on this one for me. So if we're all composed of atoms and the chair is composed of atoms, why don't you just like sink into it when you sit down?
Right. Become the chair.
Yeah, like how do your butt atoms know where they stop and chair atoms start?
Right.
That's
all the electrons doing that negative versus negative work, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me anyway.
Yeah. Who knows? I started her off early. I used to bug her with the question of the ship of Theseus.
That's a great.
Yeah, she's not a huge fan. But it's an interesting question. At what point does
Penelope, do you want to know my opinion?
Yes.
There's two ships. There's two of them now. Mm-hmm. And if you do it again, there's three of them. And this is what I base that on. That's how we make people. You know,
I like that idea. And
so there's two ships. There's as many ships as you want to do that to. And they'll all be the ship of Theseus.
I don't know if I have an opinion. I just like the question.
Yeah, it's a great question.
That's right.
Why are you asking?
That's why I think that's why it bothers her so much, is because when she says, "Well, I don't know," and I'm like, "Me either," and she's like, "Well, what's the point of
nobody knows?"
Yeah.
Penelope, I don't know. I don't know either. I'm just using arrogance, hoping that it makes me right.
That's where we all are.
Right there. Yeah. But then I think we can about wrap it up, unless either one of you had anything else for Jim here. Oh, yeah, I think Penelope did want to send you some comics. Penelope,
oh, I can't wait. I can't wait.
I was talking about, like, my circle guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I have a good idea for a comic. I don't know how I came up with it, but I just came up with it during this call, Zoom. So
nice.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm excited to make that.
Awesome. I can't wait to see it. And I will not steal it.
We trust you, that's okay, right. Jim.
It'll be
you've got it on tape.
That's right.
That's true. I'm gonna have her take pictures of it before we send it next to today's newspaper. So
okay. Awesome.
Then thank you so much again for taking the time, Jim.
And look forward to reading the new book.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one we hadn't read yet. So yeah, I'm really looking for. I love the adding the educational with that sense of humor. I love that kind of content.
Me too.
Looking forward to that. Thank you again for taking the time.
Yes, thank you so much.
And thank you very much. Nice meeting you guys. Nice meeting you, Penelope. Mm-hmm. Well, I can't wait to see your work.
Woohoo! Woo-hoo. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry, I said...